Welcome, everyone, to Sublimely Austin, the podcast where two sisters discuss all their thoughts and feelings in regards to each Jane Austen novel. This podcast will contain spoilers, so if you don't want to know the ending of each Jane Austen novel, you should refrain from listening to this podcast until you have finished them. With that in mind, grab your book and your bonnet and join us in Regency, England. Welcome to Sublimely Austin. I'm Amy.
And I'm Holly.
And we are two sisters who decided to entertain ourselves and you during this pandemic's quarantine by rereading all the Jane Austen novels and talking about them. In our last episode, it was all about Pride and Prejudice. And now we're moving on to what may be perceived as Austen's most underrated novel, at least in modern times, Mansfield Park, which was published in 1814, a few years after Pride and Prejudice. It actually did very well, like, publishing-wise, in the beginning. Although Mansfield Park, I'm just reading this off of Wikipedia, although Mansfield Park was initially ignored by reviewers, it was a great success with the public. The first printing in 1814 sold out within 6 months. The second in 1816 also sold out. The first critical review in 1821 by Richard Whiteley was positive.
So was this more popular when it came out than like Pride and Prejudice or Sense and Sensibility? Is that...
I'm not sure if it was necessarily more popular, or again, just maybe in terms of like it literally selling out with publications, like sheer numbers, I think it may have been in the beginning. Yeah, Regency critics praised the novel's wholesome morality. The Victorian consensus treated Austen's novels as social comedy. In 1911, A.C. Bradley restored the moral perspective, praising Mansfield Park for being artistic without having deeply at heart the importance of certain truths about conduct.
Mm-hmm.
By the 1970s, however, Mansfield Park was considered Austen's most controversial novel. In 1974, the American literary critic Joel Weinschemer described Mansfield Park as perhaps the most profound of her novels, certainly the most problematic.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that when I started reading this, and there were just, you know, multiple conversations where Edmund and Fanny are discussing, like, the flaws or ill judgments of other people, I was not into it. I was like, man, like, Miss Crawford is so pleasant and charming, and they're just these two stick-in-the-muds. Like, I kind of, in fact, this is why it took me so long to read it, I think, is I also had to step away from it for a bit and kind of remind myself, like, how, you know, this actually is really good. And it does kind of take a turn, I think, in terms of Fanny's character. But she's so, at the beginning, kind of much more anxious and timid. And I was not getting into it. But now, I mean, we'll talk as we go through. But now I'm, like, really happy. You know, I really enjoyed reading it once I got kind of over that first sort of, like, man, this isn't my favorite, heroine, but she's actually really great, so.
Yeah, no, I think that is one of the biggest things why Mansfield Park is not as popular as Pride and Prejudice, or even Sense and Sensibility, and certainly not as popular as Emma, because Fanny is just a much more subdued character compared to the very brash and very opinionated Lizzie Bennet.
Yeah, I mean, the book overall is also just less witty. I mean, and it's funny, like, the movie adaptations that I watched before, which were there's the 1999 one with Frances O'Connor, and then there's the 2007 one with Billy Piper, I think. Both portray Fanny as much more, like, lively, I mean, sweet, and demure, but also, like, a little more
sarcastic.
A little more sarcastic, a little more confident. You know, I mean, she knows she's kind of the
black sheep
of the family. Yeah, she knows she's kind of like the not at the same level class-wise as the rest of her surrounding family. But she's definitely like portrayed in the movies as more cheerful, and I really liked the 1999 version, which I had seen before.
So did I. I wasn't able to get the time to watch it because I was too busy, you know, binge reading Court of Thorns and Roses.
I've liked it and enjoyed watching it in the past, but this time around, it's just so different from the book that I actually was, like, not into watching it, really.
In fact, I was watching one particular booktuber, her name is Olive, and she was saying a similar thing, that she doesn't feel, I don't know how many adaptations she watched, but she was just making the point that just Fanny, her character, being a little more demure and not like, you know, Lizzie Bennet, it makes it hard to make her relatable to a modern audience in film, and so that's why they usually take those creative licenses.
Yeah, they try to make her more appealing, but again, since I finally got into the story a little bit, I was just not interested in watching these, like, very weird adaptations that are actually pretty different, even though they do hit key scenes and dialogue, I guess, that are in the books. Apparently, there's a 1983, like, series that, one, is longer, so it probably has more of the whole book in it. But I only had time to watch one of the episodes, and I wish I'd maybe started with this, because it's looking like the most true to the book that I've seen so far. It's just unfortunate that it is sort of 80s, so it's kind of like what I can find is, you know, bad quality, and even like the camera is like shaky and the music is very strange. It's just got these 80s mannerisms that kind of make it a bit of a bummer, but in terms of the characters and the dialogue, it's actually the most accurate, I think.
Right. Alrighty, but we shall get into that. But first, before we start going through the novel, we are first going to do our activity of story time, where we tell a story that relates to either a person or event within Mansfield Park. So, were you able to think of a story?
So, I don't have any specific stories because, I mean, again, it's hard to relate to, like, the exact plot for me, because, you know, I'm not a displaced person living with my uncle and made to feel less than everyone else. But what I will say is that actually a lot of the way Fanny behaves is kind of how I was, I think, when I was much younger. So, you know, I was very anxious. I was very quiet. Like, when I was with groups of people, I would not speak up. And if I had an opinion, it was very hard for me to get that opinion out. So there's, like, a scene where Fanny is sitting with, I think, it's either Miss Crawford and Mrs. Grant or Henry Crawford and Mrs. Grant. She's at, like, a dinner party at the Grant's parsonage. And they're talking about how sad it was they had to cancel the theater production, right? And Fanny's getting kind of irritated until she finally just kind of blurts out, you know, I mean, murmurs, but for her it's like blurting out, like, well, you know, I certainly think it was good it was canceled, and I think it had gone on long enough, or something like that. And then she, like, goes silent again. And, you know, I think I felt like that a lot, where I was just so kind of shy and reserved. I didn't know how to just talk normally without, like, feeling like I was offending somebody. But, you know, now that I'm older, it's like, you can, like, talk and not, like, worry about people being overly upset. I mean, maybe sometimes you can't, but I just, in general, I remember, like, being on trips and things with groups of other students, and, like, I could have been a lot more friendly and talkative with people, and I wasn't, kind of just because I was sitting there judging behaviors and not saying anything, which is kind of what Fanny does, but not in like a malicious way, just like in a, oh, I don't fit in here, I just don't know what to say kind of way. So I was like that, I think, for a long time. So, yeah. How about you?
Well, I think the thing I related most to with Fanny is sort of pushed to visit her immediate family, her parents and her brothers and sister. And she goes there, and at first she's so happy, but she realizes that she's just a totally different person, and she just does not fit in anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made me think of the times I felt I did not fit in, specifically in regards to, you know, my many travels to the Middle East and coming, you know, both dealing with the culture shock of while I was in the Middle East, but also coming back to the US and dealing with what they call reverse cultural shock, because that is a thing. Specifically, I remember it was the summer of 2012 where I had finished my summer program in Amman, Jordan. I had returned home. It was only 10 days. I had 10 days in the U.S. before I was going to go on another plane to Morocco for the whole academic year. So I had only 10 days at home with mom and dad, and just a lot of my mannerisms and stuff were still, I was still in like Middle Eastern mode. And sometimes I think mom and dad got a little annoyed with it. And I was just like, you know, I just felt there was no point in me trying to switch my ways because I was just going to go back to the Middle East. And yeah. So again, just that whole being stuck in the middle, not being accepted one place, and then you go back to your place of origin, but you're so different now and have been so influenced by the other place that you don't fit in there anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sometimes I do feel like that, like being a scientist in some ways. I mean, like amongst other scientists, I am average slash, you know, being a postdoc and not even having a full-time job, I'm kind of beneath, like, the other people around me. And, like, I have to, like, really prove myself and be on kind of my best behavior, so to speak, around all the other scientists I work for who are very knowledgeable and not mean or anything. But then, like, when I leave that circle and talk to other people, like other friends or like other family, or like when Dave's family asked me questions, like, you know, it's just this idea that I'm like, I don't know. It's just weird because it's sometimes I think I appear like super knowledgeable and accomplished, and it's not that I'm not, but just like when you go into a different sphere, it's like suddenly you're not as big a deal anymore, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And then at least for me, when I finally went to Morocco ended up probably being the best thing, because it was not the West, like dealing with reverse cultural shock, but it was significantly more liberal than Jordan, whose culture is a lot more traditional. And so while other students who had just come from the US were dealing with cultural shock in Morocco, I was just like, you babies, it was way harder in Jordan. This is great. So anyway, I think everyone to a certain degree can have that feeling of being trapped in, like, one place doesn't fully accept you, like family doesn't feel fully accepted in Mansfield Park, but neither is she fully accepted by her family because they think she knows she's, you know, sticking her nose up at them.
Mm-hmm. A displaced person.
Yes. Alrighty then, so we can just get right into the book.
Yeah, so again, my notes, I have them here, but it might take me a few moments to find what I want to say or to read something, so you might be having to cut more pauses more than usual.
Oh, no, that's fine. Let's just go through it chronologically, like all my notes were done chronologically. So first, we get this whole explanation of the three sisters. One of them marries well, like two of them kind of marry well, and then one just really doesn't marry well, at least in a financial perspective. And so that is Fanny's mother. And it's explained in this whole first chapter that it's decided that Fanny is gonna go live with one of her aunts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, it's kind of funny how much backstory we actually get. I guess Jane Austen does tend to do that. But I did notice specifically that this is the only book where our main character starts out, you know, as a child. And we kind of get this backstory of how she was sent over and is grown up. Whereas most Jane Austen books, you know, when you start out, the main character is already, like, at the age that she's going to be most of the book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I also think it's very funny that Fanny's family name is Price.
Yeah.
I feel like there's some symbolism there. But yeah.
An irony.
Irony, right, that's what I meant. So yeah, so there's Mrs. Price, who married very low class, Mrs. Norris, who married a clergyman, which is like middle class, and then Lady Bertram, who married Sir Thomas Bertram, so they're like lower gentry.
So, right.
So Fanny's definitely beneath both Mrs. Norris and Lady Bertram.
And Mrs. Norris never lets her forget it.
Yeah, she's not very nice to Fanny, ever.
No, and now I know why J.K. Rowling named Filch's cat after Mrs. Norris.
Is that a reference to this? I never thought of that before.
I would not be in any way surprised.
That's really funny.
Yes, but anyway, I think I liked the backstory with the three sisters because I think it's important to showing, like, just the class struggles, that these class struggles, you know, already were started and all were already established in the sisters judging each other and how they married, and that whole judgment just extends to the children. And so when family's put in a position of going to live with Lady Bertram and the Bertrams at Mansfield Park, like, it's very clear, you know, they phrase their actions in a way, it's certainly being done, the charity is being done for personal gratification, to inflate their own sense of self-importance, not really to help those in need.
I suppose. I mean, yeah, the wording is all very strange because, I mean, Sir Thomas Bertram has, you know, very high ideals and morals and, you know, principles, I guess is the word, about behavior and proper manners. And he thinks it would be a fine thing for them to help this girl. But, yeah, it's this very weird thing where he's not unkind. Lady Bertram isn't unkind, but they're definitely not super compassionate to Fanny. And Fanny's very, you know, kind of despondent and shy upon arriving. She's, like, very scared and sad to be away from home. Only Edward, so, I mean, we can talk about the four cousins. So she has four cousins,
yeah, so
right?
Three. She has four. The eldest is Tom, who is basically a ne'er-do-well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then we have Edward, who is
Edmund.
The one person.
Edmund.
Oh, sorry.
I'm going to keep doing that too, because sometimes I keep writing Edward in my notes, and it's Edmund.
Okay, so Edmund is the only one that's kind of nice to her and tries to, like, bring Fanny a little out of her shell. And then we've got the two girls, Julia and Mariah.
Yeah, and it's so funny because Sir Thomas tells the two girls, like, he wants them all to be friends and to get along. And he tells the girls, like, don't be, you know, rude or mean to her because Fanny's basically so far beneath you that it would, like, be a degradation for you to be, like, rude to her. Like, there's no reason for you to be rude to her because you have every advantage that she doesn't. So it's kind of like a very weird and condescending way to, like, try to be nice. It's very strange.
And it's, I guess it, you know, it's hard for us to understand in the modern world, but I think that was probably definitely, you know, a thing in Regency England, where it has so many stories about going to live with the rich uncle, like, or not so rich uncle, like Jane Eyre. And I don't know, did you read Uncle Silas by Sheridan Le Fanu?
No.
It's great, but yeah, same thing. Maud, her father dies and she goes to live with her Uncle Silas, who may or may not be a murderer.
Okay, that's a little more dramatic than here.
Yeah, but yeah, just the whole impoverished child goes to live with the rich aunt and uncle. That happens a lot. And just the idea, again, just seeing how all these petty rivalries and sense of social standing within the sisters, and that's just extended to Fanny. I don't know, the way they do it in their, like, weird condescending way, that at least would be considered condescending in the modern world. It mm-hmm. made me think of when I was working as a grant writer for that nonprofit that helped out, like, Native Americans. Like, I was specifically on the side of, like, writing grants to specific foundations to earn money for our projects. And there was another guy named Joe who was specifically, like, development in terms of trying to, like, curate donors.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he described it as he was, you know, it was like charity work, you know, trying to get donors to donate to these specific projects. But ultimately, it's like, it basically is a business. You're selling the product of feeling good.
Yeah.
But yeah, so anyway, so Edmund is the only one that is treats Fanny like a normal human being, and so they grow up together, and they say repeatedly, like, they're so worried about it that, okay, oh, like, Edmund would only ever see Fanny as a sister if she came, like, to live with us. There's, like, no threat that we have to possibly worry about.
Yeah, I mean, Edmund. I'm definitely pro-Edmund, but I mean, this is the other weird thing about this book that I guess you just have to get over, is that, I mean, Edmund and Fanny are cousins. Like, they're all cousins. So for him to eventually be, like, the love interest that she, you know, who she secretly likes, is kind of weird, and he is kind of like a brother to her. But again, you know, that's just one of those things from back in the day, I guess.
I don't know. I'm, you know, again, I don't really condone it either, but again, I'm just so desensitized from it because it happens still so much in the Middle East that really? I'm just, yeah, like, I'm just so over it, and I'm like, yep, that's how it is.
So, but she does have an actual brother. So Fanny has a lot of siblings that she left behind because, you know, I guess when you're poorer, you have more children. So Fanny has a lot of siblings, but there's one brother she was particularly attached to, William. So Edward, at one point, he kind of goes out of his way to,
Edmund.
Edmund. Oh no, I did it. Edmund goes out of his way to, get her some paper, you know, so that she can write to Edmund on a regular basis. So he's the only one.
Write to William on a regular basis.
Right. So he's the only one who's really kind of going out of his way to make her feel comfortable and at home and be nice to her. And Edmund is, I think she's 10 when she comes, and he's 16, so he's 6 years older than she is.
Yeah, and that's the dynamic that basically is carried into adulthood, where Edmund is the only one giving Fanny any sort of consideration, and Lady Bertram, while not outwardly malicious like Mrs. Norris, she just is a suck on Fanny's time. She's like, oh, I can't possibly be without family, because basically Fanny is serving as her sort of quote-unquote companion. And yeah. then Julia and Mariah are just their same. They're kind of portrayed as very stuck up and all those vain qualities.
Kind of. I mean, they're not that bad. I think there's a line later in the book where it's like they're brought up so well that you'd hardly think they had any vanity, even though they do, right? Yeah, and then another thing, I mean, I don't want to derail from what we're going to maybe talk about later with parallels, but I was sort of thinking about, you know, why, if you look online, a lot of people really are a fan of this book, and I was kind of surprised at how popular it is among people who have read it, and I never thought about this before, but this is kind of a Cinderella story. If you think about
it. Yes, it is. It is a Cinderella story.
She's like, I mean, Fanny's not an orphan, but she goes to live, you know, she's living with, quote, family, unquote, who are, you know, and it's much more complex here. It's not like there's like one stepmother and two stepsisters, but there's two females who are treated much better than she is. You know, Aunt Norris isn't great to her. But yeah, I mean, Lady Bertram is kind, but not very active, or doesn't go out of her way to do anything. Edmund is like, I don't know, her fairy godmother, kind of. He looks out for her, but also he becomes the prince later. Just her being kind of like a servant compared to the rest of them, I think, yeah. And Cinderella is such a popular story, I think that's why this book is actually, I mean, more popular than I thought it was.
Right, yes, we will go later, Heroines of the Ages, and we will discuss more parallels with Cinderella.
Sure.
Okay, so, yeah, the one, in terms of Edmund's behavior, like, being, like, really nice to her, like, I was thinking, at first I really liked the little tidbit where they want, like, Edmund wants to give Fanny a horse, but they're trying to say, oh, we can't deal with another horse, and he's like, well, fine, then I'm gonna trade in, like, one horse for, like, this mare, and so, like, he does it in a way where they cannot claim that it's an extra expense on them.
Yeah, Lady Bertram is just kind of like, oh, are you sure it's it's all right. Whereas Mrs. Norris actively tries to stop Fanny from having a horse. And, I mean, just a side note, it's made clear, I guess, that Fanny has not a strong constitution. She's
Fanny, we don't know exactly. She's disabled in some kind, and so, like, horseback riding would be the optimal way for her to get exercise.
Right, which Edmund is very thoughtful in making sure that that happens for her. But yeah, Mrs. Norris tries to squash it a bit, but doesn't succeed.
Miss Norris always tries to squash everything.
Right.
That's basically what she's there for. So, and, you know, I was thinking about, you know, Edmund's role in the family and trying to be nice to family, and we'll probably more get into this later as we go chronologically through the story. But there's also another instance where there's like this field trip they want to go on, and Edmund originally gives up his place on the field trip to let Fanny go because the others didn't want Fanny to go. And while certainly noble, what do we think about how Edmund in some ways tolerates his family's treatment of Fanny? Is this cowardly, or is he, like Fanny, trying to navigate a very precarious situation where he does not have the power?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's made very clear that the father, Sir Thomas Bertram, is a very principled but also domineering figure in the household. You know, so when he goes away, so at one point Sir Thomas has to leave and he has to go to Antigua to take care of the plantations.
The colonialism. Sorry, I just finished a review for BookTube for The Glittering Court, and I just went on this whole tangent on colonialism, so don't get me started.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, that's another thing that I think people try to make a lot of points about this book. It's not really part of this story, I don't think, to talk about
some of those
issues. But they are there. So, yeah, I mean, when Sir Thomas leaves, Mariah and Julia are actually very happy because they kind of feel like the oppressiveness of the whole house just kind of feels lifted to them, because Sir Thomas is very principled. So like,
yeah, and Sir Thomas is gone, and then the eldest brother Tom is gone.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's off doing whatever he's doing in London or whatever.
But Sir Thomas dragged his son with him to Antigua, did he not?
Oh, that's right. Tom goes
because he's like, you got to get your act together. You're gonna come with me, and we're gonna fix this.
Yeah, I mean, again, I might as well say it here. I mean, obviously, Jane Austen was an abolitionist, and she admired writers who were abolitionists. And because Sir Thomas is also in Parliament, I think it's mentioned.
Okay.
Actually, yeah. So I was reading in the introduction of the book. It's actually highly possible that Sir Thomas Bertram is also an abolitionist, and he's going to Antigua just to kind of deal with how this is gonna be like dealt with as these laws come into effect that, you know, abolish the slave trade. So I mean, that's something good to be said, I guess, about the family. But anyway, I mean, to your question about Edmund not maybe standing up more to his family, I think he just, you know, he views Fanny as a very anxious and timid person and doesn't, you know, and he understands that, but I don't think he necessarily understands that she wasn't, I mean, again, she's not treated unkindly, and she even has her own little room in the house that's for her particular use and stuff, so I don't think he really sees a problem.
Yeah, which would make sense, like, that he's blind to his family's, like, flaws in their treatment of family, because certainly he becomes blind to Mary Crawford's flaws. So do we want to jump into, you know, Sir Thomas and the eldest son, Tom, leave, go to Antigua, and while they're away, Henry and Mary Crawford come into town.
Yeah, so I mean, we didn't talk about, there's this whole thing with Tom's extravagance, and because of that, Edmund now doesn't have, they can't save the parish living that's associated with the estate for Edmund.
Right.
They basically have to bring in, you know, a new clergyman to, like, live there, because they can't save any, you know. So there's these people called the Grants, Dr. and Mrs. Grant, who come live at the parsonage. And Mrs. Grant has some relatives, some half-siblings, And that is who Mr. and Miss Crawford are. So through, like, it's not really that important, but through some marriage to someone who's actually an admiral or something, like Mrs. Crawford's, like, mother remarried or to this admiral, mm-hmm. I think. So, the Crawfords kind of come onto the scene, but also the Grants, which are, like, in the, again, bashing on the movie adaptations, they are basically kind of left out of both the 1999 and the 2007 version, which I don't like.
Yeah, I remember the late 2000s ones. I do not remember them at all, which, yeah, makes sense because I really like the actress who plays Mary Crawford in the one in the 2000s. Her name is Haley. She plays Bess Foster in The Duchess as well with Keira Knightley. I really like that actress.
Yes, I mean, other than, like, the dialogue and, like, some of the characters being changed, I really like all the casting in the 1999 version, except I would put Hayley Atwell as Miss Crawford, definitely.
Yeah.
But we didn't say, so, I mean, the Crawfords come on the scene, but just something else that kind of happens, not really, like, as a scene, but Mariah, while Sir Thomas Bertram is away, becomes engaged to a very eligible man, Mr. Rushworth. And I, side note, I think the fact that his name is Mr. Rushworth is very funny. Because kind of like rushing to marry someone who is, you know, worth a lot. Mm-hmm. So
I didn't even think about that, but you're right.
Yeah, so he, you know, as Edmund tells Fanny, if he had not 12,000 a year, we would think him, you know, prodigiously dim or something. So he's not a
and there's this whole monologue. I don't know if it's Mariah with which character, but yeah, she's basically making the decision that this engagement is the best practically, even though she's not very compatible. So she's very consciously foregoing any sort of compatibility for the financial security,
right? But because Sir Thomas is away, they can't actually marry until he
comes back.
Right. So it's just kind of this standing engagement that they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they have this standing engagement. And so Mr. Rushworth, you know, is around a lot. Then Harry and Mary Crawford come onto the scene. And that causes all sorts of problems because Henry starts to flirt with Mariah, of all people, more so than with Julia, the not engaged sister.
Right. Mrs. Grant, the clergyman's wife, specifically suggests this scheme. She's like, Miss Crawford, you should try for Tom Bertram, so the oldest son. And she suggests to Mr. Crawford that he should, you know, court Julia, the youngest daughter. And he does flirt with Julia a little bit, but he's also very interested in Mariah and thinks it's a harmless flirtation since she is already engaged.
Yeah, and I know, like, I thought it was interesting to see the perspective of the Crawfords, to see how openly scheming they were.
Yeah, it's funny because, like,
I don't recall seeing that. Like, we don't get, like, we certainly do not get Wickham's perspective of his scheming in Pride and Prejudice, nor do we get Willoughby's in Sense and Sensibility. So the fact that we get this inside with Henry and Mary is just a little, you know, I think it's meant as a literary tool too, because it definitely is a novel about morality more so than the others. So just being able to compare the good characters with the bad characters.
Yeah, I think this is in the introduction to my book, but I read somewhere that, you know, another suggested title for this book, in keeping with kind of the alliteration theme, would be Conscience and Conscientiousness. So, like, more like having good morals and a good conscience versus, like, people who are very concerned with outward appearances. I think that could have worked as a title.
Yeah, it might have. I think maybe at that point she was like, I'm sick of these titles, I'm doing something different.
It's too long. It's kind of a mouthful to try to say that.
Yeah. So, yeah, and so I actually, you know, obviously not that I condone either Henry or Mary's behavior, but I did like that twist of seeing their perspective and how openly calculating they are. And so,
yeah, they're both the same. Like Henry Crawford jokes that, well, you know, I'm sure I like Julia best because I've been advised it must be so, but there's no danger in flirting with an engaged woman. And then Miss Crawford, Mary Crawford, is also saying, like, yes, I believe Tom Bertram will do, you know, since he's going to get the house and the baronetcy and all that. So, yeah, they're very open with each other about their very materialistic or flippant attitudes towards marriage.
Yeah, so one interesting scene is, like, through the interactions between, I don't know, is there anything big that happens before they start with the theater when Tom comes back?
Yeah, so the big thing that happens, and again, this is cut from the movie adaptations, which is annoying to me, because, like, as an allegory, it's kind of interesting. There's a bunch of talk about Mr. Rushworth's estate and improving it. And he wants Mr. Crawford's opinion, because Mr. Henry Crawford's a very stylish young man. They go to Southerton, which is that's Mr. Rushworth's estate. And there are several important things that happen there. One, they're in the little chapel at Southerton. So, like, yeah, it's, I forget all of who's in the party. Lady Bertram isn't there, but pretty much everyone else. Mrs. Norris, Julia, yes. Mariah, the Crawfords, Edmund, and Fanny.
Yeah, and so in the chapel, we get the whole spiel of, like, we've already known by this point that Edmund wants to take orders, and Mary really is not into that, and so, you know, is definitely, you know, very scathing and very critical of clergymen, whereas Fanny, by contrast, has a very romanticized view of the church. And so I just specifically remember that scene of, you know, pitting the two against each other with those contrasts.
So Mary is making all these jokes about, like, oh, it must have been awful when servants were forced to, like, come to this chapel because it's a practice that Mr. Rushworth, like, doesn't impose anymore or something. And then it comes out, you know, Edmund's like, well, you know, I'm going to be a clergyman. And she's, like, completely shocked. And yeah, and then Fanny, again, this is kind of where, on rereading it, I was just not here for it. Fanny just thinks it's very noble to be a clergyman and be involved with the, you know, the people and community that you're helping. And, but I mean, yeah, I don't know. The word is priggish that I keep seeing everywhere in terms of, you know, she's just so, like, moral and upstanding that it was kind of a bit of a bummer at first. But I mean, it, you know, again, seeing what Miss Crawford is later, you kind of see that Edmund and Fanny's thinking is more correct. But yeah, and then there's the whole part where the party, different members of the party, are walking in twos and threes out and about.
Oh, yeah, throughout the estate. Oh, I had a specific note of, you know, because there's a point where Mariah and Henry, like, run off with each other in a certain area, and then, like, they didn't wait for Mr. Rushworth to open the gate.
Yeah, so first it's Fanny walking with Miss Mary Crawford and Edmund, and Mary and Edmund are kind of going back and forth on, like, whether it's worth being a clergyman or not. Mary's expressing her opinions. They have to stop to rest because Fanny is, she's, like, short of breath because we don't know why exactly, but she cannot walk for a very long time. So she sits on this bench and they continue to walk, and they say they're going to come back for her shortly, but they don't. And then, yeah, so Mr. Rushworth, Mariah, and Henry then come by. And I like how this, again, kind of quoting from something else I read, but this is like a, almost like a stage where Fanny's the audience, and then different actors kind of enter and exit the whole scene, like, kind of in front of her. But yeah, there's this iron gate that crosses into another area of the estate, and they want to go through it, but Mr. Rushworth doesn't have the key, so he has to go back to get it. But then Henry and Mariah have some very kind of interesting conversation full of second meanings, and then they, like, hop the gate, basically.
Yeah, and I've got it here in one of my notes that Gate is a symbol of the unfaithfulness that is to happen between Mariah and Henry.
Yeah, it's also, I was also reading something that this is very similar to like a part of Milton's Paradise Lost where there's like iron gates that separate, you know, heaven and hell with like a gate in front of a ditch, which is basically like the exact description of this gate here. But I haven't read Paradise Lost, so, you know, I can't really say more than that. But Mr. Rushworth comes back finding that they've both hopped the gate without him, and it was like pointless for him to have run all the way and come back. And he's very put out, but Fanny's there and she encourages him, you know, to, you know, they were expecting you to follow them, you should. So he does. And then there's like an entrance and exit from Julia briefly, where she's also like trying to catch up with them, and she also hops the gate. What comes out of at the end of the day from all of this is that only Henry Crawford and Mariah seem to be happy at the end of the day of this visit.
Everyone else is all bummed out.
Mary's bummed that Edmund's going to be a clergyman. Fanny's bummed that Edmund likes Miss Crawford so much they forgot about her. Mr. Rushworth is upset that Mariah clearly has some inclination to Mr. Crawford. And Julia's upset also because Henry Crawford likes Mariah more than her, basically.
And all of these dynamics are further exasperated when Tom comes home ahead of his father. He went on an earlier voyage than his father, so he's back at Mansfield Park. And he was describing, like, before he came directly home, he was at another house in England and they were gonna put on a play, but then one of the relatives, like, passed away, and so they had to halt the production. And he was saying what a pity it was, and they decide, oh, we'll do the play, you know, here. And so, as much as I like Mansfield Park, I was not liking this scene when I was reading it. I had to remind myself that, you know, times have changed, and just for me as like a theater geek, and I'm like, what can be possibly wrong with putting on a play? That's a perfectly legitimate way to pass one's time.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, again, I was reading this somewhere, but I mean, Austen, like, they would put on plays in her house. Like, it was kind of a common thing, like, that was done for entertainment. But yeah, again, because of this incredibly principled household, you know, this would not have been tolerated by Sir Thomas. And Edmund isn't comfortable, and Fanny's not comfortable. And again, this is more you know, this is more of why, as I was reading it, I was like, also the same way, like, really? Like, I know Fanny's our hero, but I'm just like not interested in her not liking or approving of anything. You know what I
Yeah.
mean?
I didn't get exasperated with her as being like morally like sanctimonious or self-righteous. I was just more annoyed with her sometimes of just not, you know, always sticking up for herself. And then so we get the theater, and basically upon further reflection, even though I didn't like it that much, the whole point of the theater, the theatrics, is to build up the tension between, you know, Henry, Mariah, Julia, Crawford, and then as well as with Henry and Mary. And so for me, going, you know, the whole deal with Julia and Mariah kind of quote unquote fighting over Henry, like this is reminds me of King Lear's Goneril and Regan fighting for, who was it, Edgar.
That's funny. Yeah, this is kind of a King Lear situation where Fanny is Cordelia, right? She's like the dutiful.
Yeah, she's the dutiful daughter, and then but it's the same thing. Like Goneril is the married sister, and Regan is not the married sister, and Goneril like Edgar Moore.
And Goneril is such a terrible name.
I don't know where Shakespeare got that name.
I think I know. Yeah, so I agree. I think the whole thing with Tom coming back, bringing his friend Mr. Yates, who's really into not only the idea of putting on a play, but choosing this particular play, Lover's Vows, which apparently is like a little bit scandalous.
Yeah, quite racy for the time.
Racy for the time, yeah. I think it does serve several purposes. Like you said, it sets up the tension between Mariah and Henry Crawford, who are acting. They're playing two characters that have very intimate scenes. Then it sets it up for Miss Mary Crawford and Edmund. Edmund, of course, refuses to participate, but then when they suggest bringing in, like, an outside friend to play the part that's going to be opposite of Miss Crawford's, you know, character, he kind of caves in because he does not want other people outside the family getting involved because it'll just make things worse, he thinks. So he's like, fine, I will play, you know, Ann Holt or whoever. So, you know, there's like the scene where he and Miss Crawford are practicing and Fanny is there supervising the scene and she's miserable because I think at this point we know that she basically loves Edmund.
Right. And my notes that I have here about the theater scene is the whole theater scene reminded me of Hey Arnold when the fourth graders were putting on Romeo and Juliet for the school. Yeah, because just it's the same thing of the, like, oh my god, we're gonna have to kiss on stage, oh no. And, like, again, just made me think of, like, Helga, like, scheming to get the role of Juliet because Arnold is Romeo.
Yeah, but the other, I mean, the other thing it sets up, so this is kind of a setup not just for some of the romantic tensions and where people's feelings stand, but it's also kind of a prelude to what happens in the next volume. So here, even though Edmund even caves in at one point, Fanny does not. This point, Fanny, we don't even know super well as a character. I think that's also why I was kind of not liking her as much at first, but you know, like, they try to convince her to play a small role. She will not do it. At first, Edmund is like, you know, leave her alone. But then, like, she ends up getting involved in small ways, like sewing stuff, and she helps Mr. Rushworth with his lines. She still refuses.
She becomes the stage manager.
Right. I mean, she still refuses to act until there's one point where even Edmund, like, Mrs. Grant was going to play a small part, and she drops out, so they need someone, and they're literally all begging her. And she's, I mean, she's, like, in tears, but she, like, really doesn't want to do it. But this is basically setting us up to understand that Fanny is actually so sure of what she thinks is appropriate that she will not be pressured to be obedient, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So this parallels what happens later where, you know, when she refuses a marriage proposal and just outright refuses. Right.
Yeah. And like, it shows, you know, I think Mansfield Park has gone through this evolution of people liked it way in the beginning because of its simplistic moral teachings, but then it kind of went down in popularity because they didn't like how Fanny lacked certain very feminist qualities that we like to see nowadays. But I think there has been a little bit of a receding of that, to see that just because you're not in someone's face being sassy and rebellious constantly doesn't mean you aren't strong, especially as a woman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a point not long after this, I think it's right after Sir Thomas comes back, where we get a short description of Fanny, the old schoolroom that is now Fanny's room for her own, you know, use. Where she has, like, some books and some plants and, like, a writing desk and stuff. I think when we get a description of that room is when I finally appreciate her as a character, because it's like, oh, she's, like, you know, a sweet person who has, like, these things she's interested in, and, like, she won't be persuaded by anyone to act in a way that she doesn't want to. And, like, that kind of started making me appreciate her more. Mm-hmm. More than just this, she also starts, because of this initial refusal to help with the theater stuff, it sets her up as a stronger character than we knew before, which was she was just kind of an anxious person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, so as you said, Sir Thomas finally comes home and he kiboshes the whole theater play thing. Yeah, he's just not here for it. I don't know, does he really say anything about it, or is it just sort of left unsaid?
I think it's just his, like, manner and disapproving looks and just his unwillingness to actually talk about it is like enough to relay. I think what happens is, I think Tom and Yates take off. I mean, the Crawfords kind of leave the scene before they can meet Sir Thomas. Sir Thomas talks to Edmund because he knows Edmund will, like, heed some of his words. He doesn't talk to Mariah or Julia, but I think he just, like, hopes that they will understand, like, knows that they will instantly perceive that he is not happy about this. And,
I think the only thing I remember him saying is, you know, I just, you know, I want my home to be a place of, like, comfort and stability, not, like, whatever chaos of this stupid play. Like, doesn't say it quite like that, paraphrasing in whatever would be appropriate in Regency language, but yeah, I feel like that's all he says about it.
Yeah, I mean, he burns, like, every copy of Lover's Vows that he comes across. Obviously, they take down all the theater stuff, and just those actions are enough to sort of convey his displeasure. But Edmund, when he chastises Edmund about, like, what could you all have possibly been thinking, I think Edmund brings up, you know, Fanny was actually, you know, the only one who acted rightly because she wasn't participating.
And, you know, as things progress, once Sir Thomas has come home, Sir Thomas is suddenly a lot nicer to Fanny now.
Yes, so it's been a while. I think she was like 15 or 16 when he left. Now we're kind of at the age that most of the story happened, so she's
like
18.
Yeah.
So he comes back, and it's actually really insulting, like, from a feminist perspective.
Of course.
But he's just, like, so pleased with Fanny's countenance and behavior because she's, like, quiet and, again, demure. And he's just so happy with how she's turned out that he's like proud of her because she's sort of the picture of like an ideal wife, which is, again, is a real bummer.
When I thought of this, just, you know, I think it's not just Sir Thomas. I think it's also like the Grants as well. Like just the idea of, you know, Fanny becoming into womanhood, and though there were certain elements of her character that people really did not like in the beginning, but then when she becomes like a woman and she has all this like social capital now by being a young marriageable aged woman, like people are suddenly nicer to her now. It just makes me think of, you know, my own personal experience, you know, how I felt in some ways when I started college because I felt like I didn't fully quote unquote blossom until I was 18. And I was in a different setting. Like, I went from, you know, where we grew up in the West Coast to college in, you know, upstate New York. But I felt like there was this huge change in, you know, how I was such a fashionista and still am. So I feel like people didn't think much of my, like, fashion choices when I was, like, younger. But because I had grown up, like, certain people thought I was making a deliberate decision to be provocative in my like clothing choices just because I was older and they viewed me differently. And I just felt like, it's not fair. You didn't say crap about this when I was 16. Why does it matter when I'm 19?
That's weird, because I feel like usually actually females are chastised more when they're younger. But that's interesting.
Yeah, but so that's kind of what it made me think of is Fanny, you know, again, the best way I can describe it is, now has this social capital because of her now marriageable age, and so people respect her more, which pisses me off because they should have respected her when she was younger anyway.
Yeah, again, I think even just dealing with this crazy theater business, I mean, there's a part where it even says, I'm trying to see it. Oh, here's my notes, sorry. So, I mean, she doesn't approve of the play because it's got, like, you know, an illegitimate child and like whatnot in it, which again, like by today's standards, you know, it's a play. But here's something. So at first Fanny feels actually kind of left out because everyone else is prepping for this play, and even though she doesn't approve of it, and even then she does get some enjoyment in seeing some of the proceedings, and And then when she's needed, supposedly, to help Mr. Rushworth with his lines, you know, she feels like a little bit involved in some way. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of strange. I think she still wasn't approving of it, but I think this has kind of shown her that, like, one, she can certainly tell people no, and, like, mm-hmm. it's not going to be the end of the world. And, you know, there are things that might be enjoyable that, even if it's not something as scandalous as this, but, you know, there are things that are pleasant beyond just living in this extremely strict household. So I think that helps her. I think that helps her kind of become a little less anxious as a person.
Right. So after all the theater business, Mariah marries Mr. Rushworth.
Yeah, this is
and
weird.
Even Sir Thomas has a conversation with her. It's like, you know, this is a very desirable, advantageous marriage, but still I don't want to feel like you don't have options. So if there's something, you have any second thoughts, you know, please let me know, it'll be okay. Like, he seemed to have an epiphany on this trip, and he's not now nicer to all, you know, his female charges. And so, but Mariah's just like, no, it's all fine. And so she marries Rushworth and takes Julie along with them.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, Mariah is very eager for Mr. Henry Crawford to declare himself at this point because of how much flirting has been going on, but he does. So she kind of almost wants to again rush into the marriage, even because, you know, Sir Thomas almost suspects these misgivings. But yeah, like you said, she's like, nope, I want to be married and go live in my big house. So it's also funny because it's very different than how Sir Thomas treats Fanny later. He's very nice with Mariah here, giving her, like, you know, are you sure? If, you know, I'll deal with the inconvenience of breaking it off so you don't have to worry about it. It's very in contrast to how he treats Fanny later, where he's very disappointed, you know.
Right.
So that's weird, too. But again, it's because Fanny is maybe, again, different standing in the family.
And differing expectations.
Right.
Yeah, so anyway, and then, so we have, yeah, Mariah's often gets married, continual tension between Mary and Henry. I don't know, it was just interesting, you know, we get the development of course, Mary Crawford and Edmund, and there's the whole situation, like, with the harp, and, you know, her him going to the parsonage to listen to her play the harp, and just, you know, blah. I'm just wondering, like, what did Edmund see in her in the beginning? Was it the point that she was just so flashy and trying to contrast that just because you're a posh Londoner, that doesn't make you morally good?
Yeah, I was wondering this throughout the book, because he's so principled and is so appreciative of Fanny's opinion that it's really hard to see how he was even super attractive to Mary Crawford. I'm just checking my notes here. I'm just reading something. Mariah was ready for marriage by a hatred of home, a misery of disappointed affection, and contempt for the man she was to marry.
That's lovely.
So Mariah and Julia are gone, and Fanny slowly gets more attention as sort of the principal young lady of the household.
Yes, and, like, having her, like, come out and, like, socialize more, and Mrs. Norris absolutely hates this.
She hates it. I mean, again, because she's the only young lady, she and Miss Crawford kind of have a, like, a friendship that grows. I mean, it's not very... If Fanny goes back and forth sometimes, sometimes she's just, like, she doesn't want Miss Crawford around because she can see how much Edmund likes her. And doesn't, and separately, doesn't approve of some of her, like, opinions. But then there's other times where Miss Crawford is very kind and nice to Fanny, so, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's also maybe she doesn't see everything that goes on between Mary and Edmund, and so I think the friendship between Fanny and Mary develops because, by comparison, her brother is so terrible that she at least is better at hiding her more devious elements.
Yeah, I'm trying to also remember, I think Mr. Crawford is also gone, like, When Mariah and Julia leave, I think he goes to his own estate for some reason, I forget. I have no idea why Edmund, I think she's just so charming and, like, vivacious that she's just very different than, like, his sisters or Fanny, so he's just kind of enraptured by this, I think. I mean, I think that's all it is, really.
It could be. And so, yeah, so they still have their whole bait because, you know, it's, she's kind of shown indication that she likes him, but she's, like, very adamant that I will not be a clergyman's wife. Like, I have higher aspirations for that. And she's very direct in telling Edmund this.
I mean, she always puts it in a very cheerful sort of way.
Like, sarcastic and, yeah, but...
Yeah, in fact...
Only half-joking.
Yeah, I mean, again, going back to some of the literary analysis, Fanny is, like, the serious side of Jane Austen, and Miss Crawford is, like, the witty side of Jane Austen, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah, so there's that whole tension still between Henry and Mary, and then again, Fanny's kind of coming out, so Sir Thomas decides that he's going to host a ball for Fanny.
Yeah, I mean, we can skip over this. There's like an initial, there's like a thing where Fanny's invited to dinner at the Grants, which Mrs. Norris like really puts her down about it. Like, this isn't a comp, this is a compliment to us, not you.
Oh, yeah, I remember, and I'm just, I was just thinking, lady, what is your problem? Do you have nothing else better to do?
Yeah, and I just really liked this scene before the dinner in particular because Mrs. Norris says, you know, don't expect the use of the carriage to get there. And Sir Thomas literally pops his head like around the door and he's like, Fanny, when do you need the carriage? And Mrs. Norris's face goes like red with anger. So I just enjoyed that part.
I don't know. I think my impression was that Mrs. Norris is, she married pretty okay, but not in the same league as Lady Bertram. And so I think Mrs. Norris being, I don't know if necessarily what order they're in terms of age, but the fact that Mrs. Norris is like the sort of middle daughter of the three girls that married like, you know, moderately, but better than, you know, Fanny's mom, but not as well as Lady Bertram. I think because of that, she's more insecure and is more obsessed with the sense of social hierarchy because, you know, she wants to be like, okay, at least there's someone lower than me.
Yeah. I mean, she's definitely like the evil stepmother character.
Yeah.
But before the ball, again, I mean, there's this dinner, which is a nice thing for Fanny to be invited to. So all it really shows is that she's being recognized for being, you know, she's kind of moving up in society, like you said. Before the ball happens, there's just a couple things I wanted to point out. So before the ball, Henry Crawford decides that he is going to woo Fanny for his amusement.
And Mary actually kind of disapproves of this because she actually kind of likes Fanny and does sees her as harmless and certainly doesn't treat her very badly because she sees Fanny as no threat to her own ambitions. So
yeah, she says, like, don't be aggressive or mean because she's a very sweet girl. But at the same time, she doesn't really do much to convince him, you know, not to do it. And then the other thing that happens before the ball is Fanny's dear brother, William.
Yes, William comes to visit.
He comes to visit them, and this makes her very happy. And in a weird way, Henry Crawford kind of capitalizes on this because she's in a good mood because she's happy to see William after so long. He's been at sea because he's in the Navy.
And Sir Thomas actually is quite, I don't know if it's Sir Thomas or there's someone there, you know, when William comes to visit, they don't look down on him too much because they're like, oh, he's this fine, strapping young man who has been out to sea and has braved all these adventures. And so even though he seems to be lower socially, they admire him for, you know, what he's built for himself thus far.
Mm-hmm. And Henry, to please Fanny, like, is very attentive to William, like, takes him out shooting and stuff. So anyway, yeah, then they have the ball. There's also this whole thing with the necklace.
Yes, the necklace. So basically, Mary gives this necklace to Fanny, saying it's from her brother, right?
Yeah, so Fanny has, like, a little cross that William brought her.
Yes, it was, like, given to her, like, William got it in Italy or something, and so she has this cross, and it's specifically a gold chain that's supposed to go with this cross.
Right. I mean, well, she doesn't have anything to hang it on.
Yeah.
So Miss Crawford, Fanny reluctantly, but gratefully, takes something that Miss Crawford tells her to pick. At the same time, Edmund, like, gets her a gold chain for the cross, and she's so happy with this thoughtful gift. She really wants to wear the one Edmund gave her, not the one Miss Crawford gave her, which she does because it turns out that other one doesn't like fit or something.
Fit anyway, but yeah, she just. But then, you know, she tells Edmund about this necklace, and it's like, oh, Miss Crawford is so very thoughtful that we like gave you the same gift, and Fanny's just like,
right, he. Edmund is so pleased that Miss Crawford had the same idea.
Oh no, I had just a personal story with, you know, Fanny, and my impression was, you know, I didn't write down any direct quotes, but I have on a note with the necklace, I personally know the feeling of knowing that a gift has strings. And so, because it seems, you know, I think Fanny at this point is starting to pick up on Henry Crawford's attention towards her, and at this point is still trying to ignore it, and she really doesn't like the idea of accepting this gift that she, from Miss Crawford, but she, because she knows that indirectly it's from Henry.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made me think of, again, just the notion of gifts having strings attached, especially from men. So if I want to go on a tangent, so I was in Istanbul and I had a lovely Greek friend, and she's like, oh, Amy, do you want to go into like Istanbul, into town with me? You know, there are my two friends are going to be there, and the friends and one of the friends' girlfriends will be there. And I'm like, okay, you know, whatever. You know, I didn't get out into is really Istanbul too much because our university was like an hour bus ride away. It was annoying. But anyway, so we get there and it's two guys. There's an Italian guy and a Libyan guy, and there's no other girlfriend in sight. And it's very clear from the beginning that, you know, though this wasn't certainly my Greek friend's intention, I don't blame her in any way, but it was very obvious that these two, this Italian guy and an Arab guy, wanted to treat this as a double date.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really annoying that we had to be like just very firm and very polite and very proper. And there was an instance where we went to a mall and I wanted to buy this specific dictionary for Turkish, not an English-Turkish dictionary, but more so a Turkish to like old Ottoman Turkish, like one of those, you know, translations to ancient Greek. So I go to pick up the book and the Arab guy literally tries to take it from my hands to pay for it. And I'm literally having to like hug the dictionary so close to my chest because I know this is a type of guy that I am not going to let him pay for anything because mm-hmm. I know what that will entail.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like that, just the whole deal with the necklace and knowing that it's not like quote unquote freely given and there's expectations behind it just made me think of the dictionary and Istanbul.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't going to get into it too much, but I mean, these are literally chains that she's like putting around her neck, right? So, I mean, there's definitely symbolism of like ownership there. Also, the word prison comes up a few times in this book. Like, Mariah complains, you know, she feels like her home is a prison and stuff. So this idea of being like chained and mm-hmm. not free definitely comes up over and over again a few times. And yeah, Henry, just in general, I mean, we haven't got there yet, but he is very aggressive sometimes when he's like asking her for her hand, and it's yeah. really uncomfortable. Like, it's, she just is not comfortable with any of it, and he doesn't stop, which is pretty right. awful.
Yeah, so necklace aside, but luckily for Fanny that Edmund's necklace is the only chain that works with her cross, so she's able to wear it and not have to feel bad about it.
But she has a good time at the ball.
Yes, yeah, she has a lovely time at the ball. It's basically, she's a debutante now.
It's her coming out ball, basically.
Yeah, like in essence, it's, you know, something that probably she wasn't anticipating she would ever get from the Bertrams. Yeah, so she has a really fun time, and then, well, right after the ball, first we find out, before Henry proposes, we find out that William got promoted.
Yes, Henry helps William become a
Henry helps William become promoted, and Fanny finds out about this and is so happy and grateful. And then she realizes that Henry proposes, and she realizes, oh crap, he did this because he's expecting me to accept him.
Right. Henry immediately professes his love and devotion. She's very distressed. She's almost insulted because of how, you know, she knows that he cannot be serious because of how much he was flirting before with her cousins.
Yeah. So
and she rushes out, basically.
Yeah, she runs out, and then Sir Thomas goes up to her little room to talk to her,
So
and she takes.
this is like the end of volume two, pretty much, this refusal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't think of them too much in the volumes. Yeah. But what's interesting is the sense of Fanny's moral fiber, because she gets a lot of flack from Sir Thomas for refusing Henry, and because he's basically saying, what possible reason do you have to refuse him? And we all know she's refusing him because she knows what he's like, given his behavior towards Mariah and to a further extent Julia. But she doesn't want to say that because she doesn't want to like throw either Mariah or Julia, Sir Thomas's daughters, under the bus. So she just takes all this crap because she doesn't want to incriminate her cousins in that way.
Yeah, there's a line here that I want to read because it's particularly horrible. Again, not a great thing to hear from the perspective of, how women are supposedly supposed to behave. But yeah, what I will say is, like, if I were her, I would have just been like, yeah, he was flirting with Mariah. Like, I would have had no problem saying that. But I guess she really doesn't want to have to say that for some reason. I
Yeah,
don't
and
think
I
it.
don't think it's just a personality thing that she's, trying to show how good she is. I think just for that time, even though Mariah's married and it's quote unquote in the past, like just that sort of gossip, I think would have more damage than it would like in the modern world. And so I think that you have to also have to think about that. So it's not just about Fanny being like saintly and being more morally better than the rest of us. So I think, there also was a certain level of more damage that we cannot perceive in modern times if she were to explain the true situation.
I guess. I mean, it would only be to her uncle. But here's the line I wanted to read. So, of course, Sir Thomas Bertram is berating her. He cannot comprehend why she would refuse such a good offer from someone with fortune and someone who's pretty agreeable in his eyes. So the line is, "I had thought you particularly free from wilfulness of temper, self-conceit, and everyday tendency to that independence of spirit which prevails so much in modern days, even in young women, and which in young women is offensive and disgusting beyond all common defense." Wow.
Yeah, that's
So that's pretty bad.
so
That's
the only good thing about Sir Thomas in this is that even though he makes her cry, he does all this crap, says all these horrible things, he does not say you better do it. He goes away, and eventually Edmund gets involved too, and even Edmund tries to pressure her a little.
Yeah, so I'm trying to remember. I mean, he says a lot of horrible things to Fanny that are extremely misogynistic, and again, very different than how he treated Mariah. Yeah,
Yeah.
so she's in tears, but he does leave a little less angry because, I mean, she's crying and he does know that she has like a timid and nervous disposition. So he's like, maybe she's just like kind of scared about this situation. So he kind of leaves hoping that like Henry Crawford still has a chance and that he has to kind of give her own good time to like accept it, I guess. Which again, in and of itself, is very misogynistic and
Yeah,
just
well, I
like.
think, because I think part of what was rooted in Sir Thomas's better treatment of her and throwing this whole ball for her was, again, her social capital and what she can bring now to the family in terms of connections. And they thought Henry Crawford, like just with the grants and everything, would be a good connection. And so the fact that Fanny, who has been raised up by them, that she has the audacity to refuse it, he's incensed by that.
Yeah, and so Fanny does have to rebuff Mr. Crawford a few times. And this is an interesting line, I thought, because again, it kind of relates to myself when I was much younger. So she was no judge of her manner. Her manner was incredibly, or is this incredibly or incurably? Can't read my writing. Incurably gentle, and she was not aware of how much it concealed her sternness. This is definitely how I've felt at times in the past, where I feel like I'm being very clear with someone, but I think I'm just so not a loud or in your face person that people don't know how serious I actually am. Like, I am perfectly serious, and they won't really get the gist of that. So that's what Henry thinks.
Yeah, Henry thinks basically that he can wear her down, and I have a little note here that is Henry Crawford truly reformed, or does he just want a perfect, delicate wife while he continues his same old behaviors? Like, in the hypothetical sense that Fanny had accepted him.
Oh, and Mrs. Norris is more angry that she received such an offer than in her refusing it.
Oh, yes, yes, because Miss Norris just hates family with every fiber of her soul.
Yeah, so Edmund had been off to get ordained and stuff. And right now, I think at this point, Henry's there, but
off to London at this point.
Edmund comes back after being ordained, and it's very weird.
Like, he's not as bad as, of course, Sir Thomas, not that that was very difficult. That was pretty low bar of conduct. But yeah, but even he says, like, of course I wouldn't, like, want you. Henry is, like, a very fine man, blah, blah, blah. But of course, if your heart absolutely cannot accept him, then of course you should say no and continue to say no. But at the same time, he's like, just think about it.
Right. He doesn't blame her. He doesn't, I mean, I was gonna say he doesn't try to convince her otherwise, but that's not true. He still says that she should really think about it, and that his lively personality might be a good fit for her, and like they might work together well.
And if we want to be a really apologist, maybe Edmund is thinking that maybe Fanny doesn't think she deserves this because of her previous status.
Right. I have another random note here. There's a point when Henry is again trying to like impress her at one evening. He picks up a book and he reads from Henry, is it the third or Henry the eighth? It's kind of a funny thing because, you know, Henry the eighth like courted a lot of women.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just kind of a funny parallel there for Henry, who Fanny's like the third female he's flirted with in this household.
Anyway, so, you know, Fanny's forced into several, you know, circumstances of interacting with Henry again. It's very awkward, and finally
he's very aggressive sometimes, like coming over to sit next to her and being like, what did you mean by that look? Please tell me what it means. Why won't you tell me? And it's just really inappropriate.
Yeah, but eventually gets to the point, and I think the movies do this differently. So in the book, Sir Thomas, in a nicer way, advises Fanny to go visit her immediate family. And it's in doing this, his thinking is that, okay, once she's gone back to, you know, where she realizes and she sees the difference in social standing and everything, that she will reconsider Henry and, you know, all that we have given her and stuff like that. But if I recall correctly, in the 99 version, which again I didn't watch recently, but I remember it being much more like punitive that she refused Henry and therefore he sent her off to be with her family.
So it's a little of both, I think. So in the book, she gets made this offer of, oh, do you want to go visit your family, like that you haven't seen in 8 years or whatever? And she's actually very happy and excited about this because she thinks it'll be like a nice thing to do. Sir Thomas does have kind of this secret inclination, like on this, like that he thinks to himself, oh, and maybe this will teach her how many comforts she's been experiencing these past few years. Yeah, in the 1999 version, Sir Thomas very openly sends her away as a punishment.
Yeah, like it's to the point that was so ingrained in my memory that when I actually read it in the book again, I was just like, oh, he was a lot more, nicer isn't the nice way, more duplicitous about his motivations for that family trip.
Yeah, and then in the 2007 version, she doesn't even go to Portsmouth. It's the weirdest thing. This is such an important thing for the book, and it's completely not in that movie.
It isn't?
It isn't at all.
Oh, I don't even remember the fact that that wasn't there.
Yeah, that movie, I mean, as much as the 1999 version, like, diverged in certain ways, at least it made it kind of, like, its own unique thing. The 2007 version was just this weird, diluted, yeah, I really didn't like it, actually.
Mansfield Park is a very difficult thing to adapt for a modern audience. Like, things like Pride and Prejudice and Emma that are more witty, and you can see the comedy in it, you know, and the comedy can carry it through. Like, you can't do that with Mansfield Park.
So Fanny does go home, and she is stunned. Like, her dad smells like booze. He's loud and crass.
Her mother is neurotic.
The mother is, like, got so many kids. The kids are, like, running around, slamming doors, shouting.
Like, there's only one sibling, one sister that she gets along with. And what's her name again?
Yeah, it's Susan. Yeah, so, I mean, she expects to be kind of welcomed and to, like, be able to tell them about Mansfield and stuff. And they're, like, barely interested in her. It's not the warm reception.
No, like, they're so busy, like, just trying to get on, like, with just daily logistics that there's no time to just have tea and talk.
Yeah, so she's actually kind of really unhappy and disappointed. And she comes to the realization that, you know, this isn't her home. Mansfield is her real home.
Yes, and so I have an important note for this section. You know, family visits her family. Are her complaints shallow or deep? Does she find the lack of decorum distasteful or the lack of familial affection? Could affection have compensated for them being poorer and just the whole household being more chaotic?
Oh, I definitely think so. They had been really pleased to see her, and if the kids had maybe not, like, been, like, decent kids instead of just running around all the time, like, she would have been...
And the father not be so emotionally stunted.
Yeah, well, he's, like, a drunk. I mean, it's really bad.
Yeah, so, yeah, I don't think Fanny is being, like, shallow or anything, but just wanting, like, a peaceful environment, because just because you're poor doesn't mean you cannot have a peaceful environment.
Well, right. Again, remember, she has there's like something wrong with her constitution. You know, she's sickly in some way. So, like, it's not just the noise is annoying. Like, it really affects her.
Like, it triggers migraines or whatever.
Maybe. But I do like that there's this bit here where she sees that Susan, even though Susan's manners aren't very great or refined,
she sees the potential in Susan.
Yeah, she has good sense and good disposition, and there's this, like, whole little thing with, like, there's two sisters fighting over a knife. So I really like this, not just because it's a nice thing to do. So, I mean, Fanny goes out, buys another little knife, so that one of the sisters can have it, and then Susan can have her original one back. I also like that Fanny takes to, like, improving... I think she takes out, like, a library subscription so that she can bring books back for Susan to read and stuff. Yeah. And there's, like, a little reflection here. I'm trying to find it in my notes. She subscribes to a library to borrow books and kind of wonders at her own independence. So she's, like... This is kind of the most independent thing she's done, where she's taken it upon herself to actually do something to help improve someone else. Mm-hmm. I was kind of proud of her for that.
Self-actualization.
Right. I have really liked that part.
Yeah, and I like Susan in general, because towards the end of the book, as we know, Susan basically becomes the new Fanny after Fanny gets married to Edmund.
Yeah, so the rest of her time at Portsmouth, so we have a few things. So Henry
comes
up
to visit.
He shows up to try to continue courting her, and he's super polite to the family.
Yeah, trying to be on his best behavior to show that, hey, I'm not a scumbucket.
I mean, he does kind of see them on their best days, like on Sunday when they're all, like, wearing their nicest clothes and stuff. But yeah, mm-hmm. He just comes to, like, try to continue to get her to like him, and she's even starting to waver a little bit.
Started to waver. Again, you could read it differently. My impression was that maybe she wasn't fully wavering, like, in a romantic sense, but she was just, like, sort of happy that even though she wouldn't marry him, that he was, like, had seemed to have reformed, so that maybe he'll be just better on general principle in future.
Yeah, in one of the adaptations, Fanny actually accepts him and then refuses him the next day, which is, like, a dramatic thing that doesn't happen actually in the books. But I think that wasn't, so that's something that Jane Austen herself did at one point.
So
I think they wanted to, like, put
that, like, a metaphysical homage.
Yeah, I guess. But then, you know, so Mr. Crawford leaves again to go to his estate, and then everything else that happens comes in the form of letters.
Like a whole series of letters. Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so basically what happens is Tom is ill. Because did he fall off a horse when he was drunk or something?
Probably. And then he develops a fever, yeah.
Like, so he ends up getting sick, and so Fanny is called back to Mansfield, right?
No, that's how it happens in the movie. Basically, Lady Bertram writes to Fanny that Tom is very ill. He's returned to Mansfield, but she's still not sent for. She gets letters like, oh, he's recovering, but there might be some damage to his lungs. She's still not sent for. Mrs. Crawford writes a letter speculating that if Tom dies, Edmund will get everything.
Yeah. And then Mary.
Pretty awful.
And then Mary Crawford writes to Fanny to be like, don't believe anything you hear. And Fanny's just like, believe what?
Right. And then more letters come. Well, no, her father sees it in the newspaper.
Her father sees it in the newspaper, just, you know, whatever the celebrity tabloid was at that time.
Right. So the news is that Mariah Rushworth, who's been, you know, having lots of very successful balls and parties and stuff, has run off with none other than Henry Crawford.
Shocker. And then Julia actually had run off with Mr. Yates, right?
Right. So Julia elopes with Mr. Yates, which, considering what's happening, is
they're even not that worried about at this point.
Yeah, they, like, aren't even concerned about that part. And it's funny, it explains later that the reason Julia did this is now with Mariah having done this kind of really social suicide thing, she was worried about going back to the house and being under such restraint that she just kind of was like, well, I've got to marry or I'll never be able to get out of the house.
Right.
So after all of this, after this scandal happens where Henry runs off with Mariah, Edmund finally comes to fetch her away from Portsmouth. And Susan goes with them.
Yeah, Susan goes with them, and Fanny ends up being very comforting to Lady Bertram throughout all this thing. I think it's just, you know, being able to, they thought Fanny was like a stick in the mud and whatever, but now, like, Lady Bertram and Sir Thomas can truly appreciate Fanny's moral qualities, because he's like, how the hell did my children end up this way?
Yeah, Tom is actually getting better at this point, but there is a final meeting between Edmund and Miss Crawford.
Which we don't get in person, we just get Edmund relaying it to Fanny.
Where basically she chastises the lack of discretion that Mariah and Henry had.
Yeah, rather than the actual offense.
Yeah, and she also blames Fanny because she, you know, if Fanny had accepted Henry, then maybe that could have prevented all of this from happening, which I don't think that would have
been. And then trying to put this pressure on maybe, you know, when Mariah's divorced, that Henry and Mariah can marry, and Edmund's like, are you insane?
Yeah, Edmund's like, all of what you're saying coming out of your mouth is terrible. Like, how can you treat your brother's, like, heinous behavior so lightly? You know, he basically leaves and doesn't see her again.
Yeah, and I really liked in the 2007 version, I really liked how Hayley Atwell played this part.
Yeah, I did too. She's...
Yeah, because she's about to cry, she's like, oh, such a pretty little lecture, like, you're so naive, like, not pragmatic and all those things.
Yeah, she's very, yeah, we didn't really talk about it, I don't think we specified, but even though Mrs. Grant wanted Miss Crawford to go after Tom, I mean, she was clearly very interested in Edward specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so like you said, Sir Thomas Bertram kind of reflects on his failures as a parent because he taught, again, his children like to have good manners and whatnot, but not really a good, like, disposition. Mrs. Norris is for once stupefied because she was very proud. She was kind of partially responsible for making the match between Mr. Rushworth and Mariah.
Yeah, so it reflects badly on her.
So she, like, can't believe it. She also can't believe that even though Sir Thomas plans to support Mariah, that she's not welcome back in the house.
Yeah, and so Miss Norris goes to be Mariah's companion in her shameful exile.
Yeah, because Henry decides not to marry her and abandons her. And I love this about Mrs. Norris and Mariah, their tempers became their mutual punishment.
Yeah, no, I remember, I liked in the 2007 version that I think Edmund, like, and Fanny are watching Mrs. Norris go, and it's like, I wonder if it's a greater punishment for Mrs. Norris or for Mariah.
Yeah, Edmund, again, it kind of, the last chapter is kind of doing this thing that some movies do, where they kind of go through each character and, like, this is what happened to this character, and this is what happened to this character. So, I mean, you know, Julia married Yates. Susan came and became Lady Bertram's new, like, little assistant.
Companion, it was the term.
Yeah, Tom got a lot better and he was fine. Edmund realizes that he loves Fanny and finally figures out that she has loved him all along. And Sir Thomas is completely fine with this since Fanny is, like, the best child, basically, that he has raised.
At this point.
At this point. And that's pretty much where the book
ends. And that's pretty much the end.
Okay, so that was a lot, because this was a very long book. It's the longest one.
It is a very long book. Is it the longest book?
I don't know. It's over 400 pages.
Yeah, that's pushing it.
Emma's pretty long, but I think this might be the longest.
I feel like Emma's, like, maybe long, but I feel like the action is so fast-paced that you don't tell in the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
And now we're going to move on to Heroines of the Ages, where we compare the protagonists of each episode's novel, this time being Fanny Price, with heroines of other females in literature, film, media, and whatever. So we went into it a little bit in the free-flowing discussion, because this is very much a Cinderella story. And this is definitely the heroine that I first thought of when I was reading Fanny.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I brought up before, there's so many versions of Cinderella-type stories that, like, you could probably pick any one and it would be maybe a bit of a comparison. So, I mean, that's true for overall story. We can elaborate on that a bit more. I will say that, though, Fanny in this book, like, as her actual character, is, again, such a very quiet and timid person that I couldn't really think of any other characters that I really think were similar to her.
Yeah, the only one I can kind of think of is Jane Eyre, but even Jane Eyre is a little bit more rebellious in a lot of ways, but she just follows the same template of going to live with the rich aunt and uncle.
Yeah, I mean, and Fanny Price, I think, in terms of other Jane Austen females, has been compared mostly to Anne Elliot from Persuasion a little bit.
Oh yeah, you're right.
But yeah, I mean, outside of Austen, yeah, I mean, you can probably maybe try to find side characters who are very quiet, but then, you know, they're not prominent characters if they're not the main character. So, but yeah, right, but definitely,
No, just going back to Cinderella, like, again, I think that part of the reason why people maybe don't like Fanny as much, for the same reason that a lot of feminists bash on Cinderella. And I have grown to appreciate Cinderella as I've gotten older because, have you seen those YouTubers, like, they used to be called Scream Prism, but they're now called The Take, where they analyze, like, characters and archetypes in, like, film and media?
No, I mean, I watch other YouTube channels about storytelling where they talk about story archetypes.
Yeah. So there's one, so they did a very specific video on Cinderella, and I really liked what they said because they were showing that basically if you want to criticize Cinderella as not being like sassy enough or feminist enough, that that in itself is quite victim blaming and just going through the realities that Cinderella, like Fanny, is in a very precarious position. She is at the mercy of relatives who are wealthier and more powerful than she is, and she's not in a position to speak up all the time or talk back, and people consider this to be weak, but in reality it's just choosing practicality and pragmatism over, you know, an immediate, you know, gratifying feeling of justice.
Yeah, I mean, this is what happens with people who are in, like, pseudo or outright, like, abusive situations is, you know, they often become very sheltered and they're not gonna stand up for themselves. So, you know, and also just Fanny's personality is very quiet. Like, not everyone is, like you said earlier, a Lizzie Bennet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Fanny, I would argue that she does stand up for herself. I mean, she's very, like, not confident about it in the way she does it sometimes, but she's very confident in, like, her own judgment. So, like, even though ideally the thing for her to do would be very obedient all the time, yeah, like, she does not, I mean, she puts her foot down in her own way.
Right, and then again with Cinderella and the illusions with Fanny, you know, a lot of people harp on Cinderella that she just waits for the prince to save her, But as those two YouTubers rightly say, she wasn't looking for Prince Charming. She just wanted to go to a party and have a night off.
Yeah, again.
And the fact that it's Prince Charming does, that's not so much her being passive and necessarily promoting this passivity in women. It's more of a sense of poetic justice, like when Lizzie Bennet gets the super rich Mr. Darcy.
Yeah, yeah. Again, when I say there's lots of iterations of Cinderella, there's one I really like. Do you know it's Ever After with Drew Barrymore? Have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen it, regrettably.
I really like that one because, you know, I mean, it's kind of the same thing where she's grateful to her, you know, stepmother for letting her stay there in a way, even though she's not super nice to her. It's kind of weird where one of the sisters is kind of nice, but the other one isn't. But she also, like, meets the prince without knowing he's the prince right away. Like they have a relationship before. It's not just her going to a ball and meeting him for the first time, but he doesn't know who she is. But anyway, yeah, I really liked that version.
Mm-hmm. And likewise with Fanny. Fanny was not, you know, is passive, but she wasn't expecting anyone to rescue her. Certainly, she wasn't expecting to elevate herself by marrying Edmund, and then suddenly everyone's going to treat her better. Like, she fully, even though she loved Edmund, she fully did not, you know, expect or make any moves toward trying to make those feelings to be returned. So yeah, just again, that I think it's a notion of passivity that I think is unfair to place on both Fanny and Cinderella.
Again, you know, with going back to how I think I was perceived sometimes when I was younger, like, just because someone, you know, you think is super passive outwardly doesn't mean that that's how they feel about themselves, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Alright, then, yeah, I honestly could not think of any, like, super big modern ones besides Cinderella. You said you didn't either, right?
No, I mean, again, she's a displaced person. She's, like, the one who's kind of taken on a pseudo-servant role. It's just so strongly a Cinderella-type story, and then, you know, other than that situation, there's not really another story archetype where, you know, someone who may be, again, perceived as very passive or put upon is, like, the hero. You know what I mean?
Right. And on that note, shall we move to the Austinometer?
Sure.
Okay. Alrighty then. Category number one, The Charming Rake. What did you give this?
I would say, well, this one's hard because, I mean, Henry Crawford is definitely a rake. Like you said, it's hard to know if he's actually reformed or not. He does run off with Mariah, so I guess he does do a terrible thing, kind of. Yeah, I'd say an 8.
Okay, yeah. For similar reasons, I gave him a 7. Like, again, I kind of liked the, you know, literary star. I liked that we saw the insight into Mary and Henry's characters. But again, just, I feel like, not that the damage to Mariah wasn't vast, I just feel like his dubious behavior, I feel, did not have quite the same impact, immediate impact, and given the closeness to the protagonist as it did, like, with Sense and Sensibility and with Pride and Prejudice.
Yes, like, Lizzie Bennet really likes Wickham, and Marianne really likes Willoughby, and then they go off and, like, break
hearts. I guess he's lower, not because he isn't any less of a rake, I think it's more lower than Wickham and Willoughby because Fanny isn't as taken in by him and already kind of knows what he is.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So his influence is lesser, even though he himself, of course, is a scumbag bucket.
Yep.
Okay. Alrighty then. So category number two, obligatory clergyman. I gave this a 5.
A 5, really? I would say, yeah, I would say a 6 because Edmund is going to become a clergyman, of course, and there's a lot of discussion about being a clergyman. And actually, Miss Crawford, I would say, does make some good points about people abusing that status and using it just to, like, not be a very good clergyman, you know?
Yeah.
And just get the benefits of living in a nice parish house that they might otherwise not have. But yeah, but Edmund's so serious about it. We don't get a lot of Dr. Grant as a character himself.
No, we don't. Yeah, I gave it a 5 because certainly it's higher than Sense and Sensibility, where again, like, all of the dialogue about Edward in Sense and Sensibility wanting to take orders that is all like made up in the movies to give Edward some substance, and we don't get it firsthand himself in the book, whereas in Mansfield Park it is an actual role, specifically in the tension between Edmund and Mary, and Mary just will not in any way marry a clergyman.
Yeah, I'd say 6.
I'm still giving it a 5. Alrighty. Regrets and bad decisions.
Well, I would say our protagonist does not regret anything, really, because she kind of holds her ground. I think right. She's disappointed at times. I think when she goes home to Portsmouth, she's very disappointed. I don't think she necessarily regrets leaving her family there. But I think Mariah definitely regrets what she's done. I think Edmund feels a little bit of regret about his behavior with Miss Crawford, in spite of like all her very obvious flaws. But it's not a lot of regret. 6.
Yeah, I'm giving it a 4. Because again, I'm putting more emphasis on the fact that unlike Lizzie Bennet figuring out the truth about Wickham, unlike Emma going through all her trials and tribulations and realizing that her interference doesn't always yield good results, you know, and I think that's why maybe people criticize Fanny, that she's so bland and morally upstanding that she maybe doesn't change all that much, and so maybe people ding her for that, but I like that part of her character, so she doesn't make any big decisions that she regrets, and so yeah, I give it a 4.
Yeah, I think she changes a little bit as a character.
I think she does, but I think she doesn't change in that very obvious way.
No, not like Elizabeth Bennet, like, regretting everything she's said ever.
Yeah, or Emma.
Yeah.
Alrighty then, and then category number 4, wealth as poetic justice.
It's hard to say, because this one doesn't wrap up as nicely.
No, it doesn't. We don't know what Edmund's, like, salary, quote-unquote, is when he takes the parsonage, right?
It might be mentioned once. I think it's, like, 700 a year, and I'm just guessing, unless I got that from one of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say it's pretty low. I mean, because Fanny, I mean, she gets to stay connected to the family and she gets what she wants. But yeah, Edmund's not going to be super, super wealthy. And Fanny's not out for, like, poetic justice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Trying to think of some of the other characters. I mean, Mariah ruins herself. And then Miss Crawford and Henry, like, kind of just disappear. We don't know what happens to them.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say 4.
4? Okay. Yeah, you're much lower than me. I gave it a 7 just because it's not so much poetic justice, like, marrying into specifically Edmund and that being a very advantageous marriage, but I think the fact that she grows in the esteem of the Bertrams, and so maintaining that connection, and she and Edmund will benefit still from that connection.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I was thinking, like,
I think naturally with Jane Austen, when we think of wealth as poetic justice, we immediately think of it as advantageous marriage financially, but it doesn't necessarily always have to be in that form.
Yeah.
And then category number 5, feminism.
So here's what I'll say. I really admire Fanny as a person, and I like how she goes from being more quiet and anxious to at least standing her ground a little bit, even though it still will, like, make her cry and stuff. So I really like her fortitude, but there is a lot of really depressing language from all the male characters. Sir Thomas Bertram has his really condescending views of what a good, you know, woman should be.
Even in other books where people, like, you know, when Lizzie's mother is trying to pressure her to accept Mr. Collins, like, no one goes to the extremes that Sir Thomas does in using the level of misogynist language that he does.
But it's not just Sir Thomas, like, and it's not just the men. Like, Henry has, like, so Henry definitely at some points, like, talked about how Fanny would make a perfect little wife. In fact, that might have even been Miss Crawford's phrasing. Lady Bertram also at one point says, "Oh yes, it's certainly your duty, dear, to accept such an offer." Like, it's just really, like, not pro independence for a female. So yeah, I'd say 3.
I'm just trying to think of, is she portraying all that not to, like, portray the, or just bolster up Fanny's sense of quiet feminism? So I don't know. I'm gonna 4. So tally up your marks. What was your ranking overall out of 50?
Oh, I didn't write mine down as we were talking. Should I do that? Okay, I gave
Yeah, you should do that.
Now you have to remind me.
Okay, 27, and let me do mine. Alright, yeah. I think I also gave it 27. Wait, let me check this. Yep, I also came out at 27.
Interesting. So that's definitely much lower than I think we scored the first two.
Yeah, well, because definitely the whole nature of the Austenometer is very much skewed towards a plot line that's much more akin to Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility, and just Mansfield Park just totally deviates from that.
But it is still, I would say, a very good book.
Yes, and I really like it, and I think people should not be hating on it the way they do.
Yeah, I get why people do, because I, like I said, I was not into it when I started reading it, but then it like grew on me.
Yeah, it's not even just, you know, Fanny being passive or not being as funny. Again, to me, the biggest hurdle I had to get through was theater business, because it's just something that has not aged well, like in terms of the sense of propriety and whatnot and the ways we view theater now.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, that is that. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Tune in next time as we delve in to our next Jane Austen novel, The Wayward, Very Not-So-Good Matchmaker, Emma.
That'll be a fun one.
That will be a fun one, because that was the first, I think that was the first time I'd actually, like, read it. And I don't think I fully read it. I think I listened mostly to the audiobook, but it was a very good audiobook. Alrighty, so stay tuned for Emma. Talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Bye.